SiriusXM Sports presents
At the Races with Steve Bick.
Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back. Hour three. We're coming to you from Savannah, and I'm laughing because I see a picture of our friend Stu Glogoff, who has got a picture hammer. He's in Tucson. He lives in Tucson, and there he is with a little snowball that he made because it's snowing in the desert. Good morning.
Good morning. I was just going to say, I bet it's warmer there than it is here.
No.
No?
It's snowing.
No, it's Savannah.
Oh, Savannah, it's gorgeous. Yeah, we finally got some decent weather. Yeah, I thought you meant in Tucson.
No. It actually snowed, and they say it snowed in Malibu. It snowed in the mountains above Malibu yesterday, which is, you know, once every 20-year event. So it was in the 30s this morning. I tell you, when I got up, I'm not out in the garage in my little office out there. I'm in the house today, I'm telling you. it's a little nippy.
Unbelievable.
But it's all right. That's all right. I went out to Santa Anita yesterday for the first time since we parted ways. And before I go any further, I have to ask you this question. I said I would ask you. I think I know the answer. Someone asked me, we were talking about you and the show and everything, if you'd ever done play-by-play. And I said, I think you did in college, but you can go ahead and fill in that answer for us.
I was the play-by-play voice of Colgate Red Raider hockey for 4 years.
Okay. Because you have that play-by-play rhythm and mentality and storytelling ability, and I said, I think you did. So, Larry, if you said you were going to listen for the answer, you've got the answer. So I wanted to do that. But I went out to Santa Anita yesterday for the first time. I tell you, I was a little nervous, to say the truth, going back after not being there for a while. But very welcoming, and it's a little quiet over there. That's all I'm going to say. A little quieter than when I was there. Of course, like my wife says, any room that I leave gets quieter. But just a little different attitude. But one of the good things, I got to see a lot of people, and it was kind of neat. Ran into Victor Espinoza and his agent Brian, and big smile as normal, and the Hall of Famer is back 100%. So he's accepting mounts and getting ready to go. That quote, there's not really a trial period, but he's back. So you'll start to see him on some horses, and he's ready to go. So it's always nice to see that smile coming out of his face. And so that was good. And just a little different for me going back there. But like I said, a lot of old friends, or not even old friends, but friends I hadn't seen in a while, welcoming back. So we got there in the morning, and then probably tried to make a few afternoon visits as well. And that's it. But I listened to Hugh talk to Jay Krivman, and, you know, the three-year-old story as we get into late February. I think we were about this point last year, and we were talking about how kind of boring it was, nothing going on. And then the Justify came in, and that gave us something to follow, and it cranked up. And I probably look back, we'd probably say the same thing every year, but we're getting to that point now. I think part of the reason is, you know, just the way things line up. They don't run as often. You got three of the top four in the Derby watch that haven't run since November, so we haven't seen them. And now what it looks like it's going to be, we're going to have two blockbuster races ahead of the Derby soon, with the Fountain of Youth kind of capturing a lot of the horses in the southeast, and then the San Felipe here. I mean, you get to that time on the calendar, and you look down, and, you know, you have 5 points, 8 points, 10 points, and boy, you do have to run. And what puts some of these horses behind the eight ball is they can't all win, and depending on where that point cutoff line is, they got to make hay now. And some of these races are going to kind of pretty tough. I mean, if you're going to have Game Winner, Implorable, and Instagrad to lead off the San Felipe, I mean, obviously, they're all not going to win. And a couple others in there, and it looks like the Fountain of Youth is going to be loaded, too. So on the one hand, it doesn't seem to take as many points to get in because the horses aren't racing as much. But some of these horses are behind the eight ball, Steve.
There's no doubt, and I think that you know some of the ones that have been waiting, they're going to end up finding themselves a little, you know, a little much on their heels if they don't score right away. And I kind of alluded to that with Jay because that group that's coming together for the Fountain of Youth. I mean, there's going to be some serious heartbreak. I mean, the horses that finish, I mean, hell, even third is you know you're going to. Yeah, there's going to be some people that get nothing, and they're going to have to, you know, swing for the fences. And of course, I think it was at some point in Jay's discussion that I was going to interject about the 18th Monday, and you know the notable anniversary, and it was all over Twitter certainly of. The debut of Justify. And so I don't know if we're going to use that as the benchmark that if you haven't, you know, if you hadn't debuted now by, you know, by February 18th, you can't win.
That sounds probably pretty good. And then, you know, a couple of years will be March. But, you know, it really does take away to some of the drama leading up to it. But, you know, I think some of the guys have figured out, if I don't run, I can't lose or, I can't get an injury and I just want to get to the game. And I get that. But somehow, you know, we seem to lose out. And you're right about these preps, and we talked about it, I talked about it consistently. You hate to run the prep before the big one, and you hate to see some of these horses, you know, maybe one of these big three needs a race and runs up the track. And then you got to think, well, geez, what do I do now? Then they have to go and win, and maybe one gets left out, which is not what we want. But, it's all how you play it. Everybody knows the rules going in. But it looks like between the Fountain Youth, which is what, next week, right?
Yes.
Fountain Youth is next week, and then the San Felipe is the week after. So between those two, which are preps for the final prep, we're gonna see where the line is. Somebody's gonna put a line in the sand, which makes War of Will, you know, kind of a bandwagon type horse. You get to see him run. He's run good a couple times. He's got likable owner, likable trainer, and got likable rider. It's kind of a plus plus. So I jumped on the bandwagon. I wouldn't mind seeing that horse do good, and he has done good, and he's taken the Louisiana Derby kind of quiet route, and I haven't seen too many people decide to go down that way and face him in that. So he might be the lone wolf down there coming out of Louisiana, which is not a bad thing.
I don't understand. I've seen some naysayers that are trying to find fault with him. I don't really get it, to be honest. Maybe it's just I've got the advantage of having been standing there in the paddock gawking at him. I don't know how much more development there's going to be, but and he might. Right now, I said this to Jay, he might be a man against boys, and other horses are going to keep developing on their own timing. And by the time we get to Churchill, it may be a whole different, you know, kettle of fish. And of course, there's also the, you know, the time between the start at, you know, Fairgrounds in the Louisiana Derby and then, you know, Kentucky, you know, that spread. And for whatever reason, this has been a you know, an unproductive route to the Derby. And of course, the flip side, which is so bizarre, is how productive the Philly side has been when it comes to the Oaks. I mean, it's kind of weird that you can't really figure, you know, what the disconnect is or the connect, but for whatever reason. But if for people who haven't seen him physically, we may get to Derby week and there won't be a better looking horse in the field. I mean, he is just breathtaking. So I'll reiterate again, when you see a chart of one horse that stayed on the pace and the next five horses were last, second to last, third to last, fourth to last, and fifth to last, when you see that, it's a glowing endorsement of a winner. And that's that. I guess we're back to trust the process, trust your eyes. I guess. I mean, he was impressive.
I was totally impressive, and I don't know how anybody can really knock him.
Yeah, it's very strange.
But we'll see. Now you mentioned the the pick, the Magna 5 or the Strong
yes.
5 carryover today. I believe since we started this back 6, 7, 8 months ago last year, this is the first carryover. So
I think there was what Johnny corrected me. I thought so too, but Johnny said there was one smaller carryover near the beginning. Like maybe the fourth week, there was a small one.
Okay. Well, this is the largest, I'll say that.
Yeah, this is a real carryover.
And somehow this bet gets hidden on a Friday, and maybe this will give it a little bit more exposure. But $170 in there, it's not going to reach a million, but it's going to be $500,000-$600,000, I would think. Maybe it will.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
A tough sequence. It's a dollar bet. It starts in the Laurel Ninth. So I started looking at it. Now 2 days ago when I looked at the weather in Laurel on today, it was supposed to be slop. So I was looking at slop horses. But a very tough sequence. You mentioned the Laurel Ninth. I would take and I have to redo that one because I looked at the slop on there, and I had a couple of horses in there that I probably wouldn't use. But there's a couple of chalks there. It's a beaten 5,000, and those are not my favorite races to handicap, but I'll take a little extra on that. Then we get to Gulfstream. You got a 2-in-the-end filly mare race going along on the turf. A regular race, a good race. I usually try to find a horse under the rails at 60 feet, and I don't know. I don't even know what that means, to tell you the truth. If they're on the inside course, the outside course. So I try to ignore that because the course is so big. But found a few horses in here, Battle of Blenheim. And then three of them on the outside. CV from Kelly Breen is going to have some speed. Lone Speed might use him. Medal of Honor. And then Siding Spring with Ortiz on there. Horse that's already won the condition and comes back for the tag. Not a bad race there. Could kind of narrow that down to three or four. Then we go back to Gulfstream for the old Maiden 20 on the turf. And don't get a chance to see a whole lot of these out here, although that's in the future is what I'm hearing. But a couple horses in there that I liked and looked at were the droppers. I seem to always go for the droppers here. Tony Morgata has a horse in there that he's just got off of Pletcher, second time back. There's a first-time starter from George Weaver, which, you know what, not big first-time starters for the Maiden 20s, but the field has so many you can toss that Moe's Ride with Irad Ortiz getting on for the first time might be a play in there. And then there's the speed horse from Alan Iwinski, Wine at the Beach, that's worth taking a look. I mean, there looks to me like there's a half a dozen throwouts that just got beat off, and you got to hope that some of those don't get in there. It's a tough race, but those are the races maybe you can narrow down. You get to Golden Gate, you got a Maiden 8, which I had to laugh at myself last night. I'm watching replays of Maiden 8s, which I don't do that often. But I'm laughing. Going, oh, you got to be kidding me. But anyway, I wanted to particularly, there's a big common race in here, the Daddy's Mistress race, and I wanted to pay particular attention to the horse that ran second there, Princess Run It. The rest of them were kind of, didn't do much. This was the horse's first start. Ran a little green early, but finished with a little gusto. So I'm going to try and narrow this down to Princess Run It and a first-timer from Bill Delia called Shamboozle, just because some of these are so bad. But Princess Run It looked good to me on film, and that's about as best way to handicap that as I could. And then we come here to Santa Anita for the final leg down the hill for Phillies allowance race. And I tried to narrow that down, too, because it looks like you're going to have to go wide early. But Bataquitos from the Bill Spar barn came back from a little bit of a layoff, took the lead, and got run down late. I like that kind. So Bataquitos looks live in here. A horse from Phil D'Amato, who's the most recent winner, November. A lot of horses haven't won in here in a long time. So he's the most recent winner coming over from the Aqueduct New York circuit. Chad Brown trained him, so if there's some of that magic left, he might be okay. He's a price merger arbitrage, and then Special Purpose. I mean, how do you pass that name up? You know, the new phone book's here. On the outside, Simon Callahan, who's done really well. I've had a good meet, and there's another horse that's coming back second time off the layoff since May, Special Purpose, on the outside. So I would take a look at this. You might have to get on the phone and call a buddy or two and, you know, put a decent ticket together. to hit it, but I think it's going to be worth it. I think this is a good bet every Friday. It does get lost in the shuffle, but definitely worth taking a look at today. And then real quickly, the Buena Vista on Saturday. Phillies and Mariners going a mile. Now we got Vasilika in here, and she has blown up the whole for years. We've had if you win a race here in one of these stakes, you toss them. I think we went like 15 graded Philly and Mare races on the turf in a row without a double winner. But Vasilika just if she's not the claim of the decade, I don't know who is. But she just went on an absolute tear last year, winning 9 of 11 after Jerry claimed her. And I think she was in the November sale. They pulled her and said, let's roll it again. So she's only 5. She's back in the megahertz, and expect to see her all over the place this year. But she's very, very tough to beat in here. Fawn Mara from the Sorin Barn will take the lead. Proved tough to run down. Vasilika got her last time they faced each other. But she could be tough on the lead. And a little horse that maybe might get up or be involved in a trifecta is Athena from the Jack Carrava Barn, who doesn't have a ton of stake horses, but when he gets one, he knows how to use it. He's done a great job at this with this filly. So I mean, those are the three that I take a look at. But Vasilika, I mean, you just watch her. She's a special filly, and she's the best of these. So that's what we got here, you know, a couple of weekends as we wait for out here anyway, the March 9th weekend with the Sandy the Handicap and the San Felipe kicking off for the head of the Derby trail.
Excellent. Well, Hammer, I appreciate it, and stay warm. can't say that too often. Shame about the weather, if I can pull out a
point. Oh, I love it. So anyway, enjoy your trip back up the coast, and thanks for having us, and enjoy the weekend.
Excellent. Hammer, everybody, away they go, and looking forward to getting back out to Santa Anita for the Derby week, and not going to be there for San Felipe because we're going to Tampa ahead of the HPPA convention. The HPPA convention is the next Wednesday, Thursday, Friday at Clearwater. So I thought let's tie in and get to the Treasure Coast and first Tampa Bay Derby in a long time. Is it possible? My last Tampa Bay Derby might have been, I guess it was Street Sense and Any Given Saturday. I think it was. I'm gonna have to check the notes. I'm pretty sure it was. So that obviously goes back. I'm going to have to look at the list of winners. I can't remember being there for another one since. I've been there for a couple of, from other, other options. Ed DeRosa, I think, going to join us now, and or Quigley, one or the other, not both. But bottom of the hour, really looking forward to the visit with Barry Meadow and his new book that you can order now. You can go ahead and order Barry's The Skeptical Handicapper, using data and brains to win at the racetrack. You'll hear all the details. If you get a hold of Barry ahead, take some notes while we got a second, while we wait for the next visit. He'll be ready to ship March 1st, and obviously next week, just days away. But he'll give you an autograph and include the shipping cost. And as Ed DeRosa joins us, I can reference back, Ed, to the first Ron Rippey award victory that we gave to Barry Meadow.
Yeah, and I believe I'd be shocked if some of the research that went into that article that was in the Horse Players newsletter didn't find its way into the book. So looking forward to reading the finished product, and obviously a titan of a name when it comes to handicapping and being able to express what goes into the art of not only picking winners but betting on them effectively. So
exactly.
Looking forward to an addition to the Letters of Handicapping.
very much, and get two, so that you can give one to, you know, to your favorite. Your favorite aspiring player as well. And, you know, Ed, having been down at Fairgrounds with Scully, I got to tell you, you guys are going to send him down there one of these trips, and he's not going to come back. If the new wife is with him, there's a real chance that he's going to, you know, he's going to put down roots.
Well, what's not to like about down there? Although there are a lot of places I find I like in moderation, so... Not saying New Orleans wouldn't take hold. It seems like anyone who's from there can't wait to get back. So myself included, I'm not from there, but I can't wait to get back to the Louisiana Derby.
Well, I don't think Davy Carroll and the Cassie Barn, you're not going to be too welcome around there Derby week, considering you don't think much of Warren Will, apparently.
Well, I was talking about this with, I think, on the Colin show last night, because I have Galloway in number one. And admittedly, I'm sticking my neck out. I just think this time of year, it's good to have some strong opinions one way or the other. And with War of Will, I just feel like after two stakes wins and, you know, there's the race at Churchill, I thought any of the three, there was maybe an opportunity for a bust-out performance figure-wise, and we haven't seen it yet. So I'm just thinking as the price gets lower, it's hard for me to get excited. Now, for those who like him and for those who, you know, are into, oh, the way he did it, or they see something the way he runs, God bless you. That's a perfectly fine way to assess potential Derby horses. We all do it our own way. I'm a very much black and white when it comes to the numbers at this point in the year, and then we'll roll in some other thoughts, with Gary Young on site and what we see in the weeks leading up to Derby. But for now, I'm looking for the horse who can prove he's fast, and, you know, War of Will certainly has done nothing wrong on dirt. But given the buzz, I'm just kind of saying, hey, I want to see a triple-digit number before we get too excited at a short price.
Well, and there's a few nuances to the configuration and to the racetrack, and I'm anxious to see the next step as well. I'm certainly a Fig guy. The Fig there may be, I don't know, it may be, I just think, a little deceptive to what you had going on. That the chart in this case really, to me, speaks volumes. The way, the closers all came and none were certainly getting to him. We'll revisit.
A horse he beat in the LeCompte, a horse who had faced many who were in the LeCompte and was 6-1 for the Smarty Jones ended up winning the Southwest at 60-1. So,
that's right. That's right.
I'm not saying, hey, just discount this whole group, but at this stage, just trying to balance the horses we know have shown some brilliance, like Game Winner and Improbable, with some other looks as well. And that's just kind of where I am with the list now. But obviously he's to be respected. He's going to be easily one of the choices when we have Derby Future Wager number three. And hopefully my bona fides with the Cassie Barn are secure. I've been a cheerleader for several of their runners. And, just can't love them all. So this is one where I'm willing to take a wait-and-see approach, given that others are already on them.
What else caught your eye over the weekend before we talk about tomorrow?
Yeah, I was impressed with Serengeti Empress and a little confirmation bias. I was pretty high on her going into the Breeders' Cup, and I don't know if the tank was empty or maybe Jaywalk and others are just better. But it was good to see her bounce back, and I definitely think Tom Amos has some looks with this one. So eager to see what she does moving forward toward the Oaks. And, the Fairgrounds has had some great success with the three-year-old fillies. And if there's one reason I'd be rooting for War of Will, even if, currently wouldn't be, on many of my tickets with a long way to go, would certainly be to see the Fairgrounds finally bust through with the Derby star after we've seen, you know, a lot of circuits share the love, including New Mexico in 09 with Mind That Bird. So New Orleans long overdue to send a winner up the river.
Yeah, there you go. Overall, the quality, you know, these big Saturdays have been just I've been basically chronicling them with Marcus Hirsch, and they've just been, you know, very productive. There's a lot of good horses, it seems, concentrated down there, and it's unusual after Monday, certainly when it came to the Southwest, it is a little unusual that it feels like Oaklawn is playing a little catch up for whatever reason, that the Hot Springs 3-year olds are a little behind the New Orleans 3-year olds.
Yeah, I'd say that's fair. And, I mean, look, Pletcher ship went in. Granted, it was a maiden race, but, for the local owners to get a win like that on the big day. But, that maybe shows that the horse's base there. Catch up, I think, is a good term. But as we've seen with that route to Kentucky, and I'll mention another, Pletcher ship super saver in there, was second in the Arkansas Derby, and Danza, who won it and ended up third in Kentucky. So one of the benefits of their meet with the four Derby preps is you definitely get a progression. And as we know, these three-year-olds can get good in a hurry. So definitely don't sleep on Oaklawn, but agree, from what we've seen so far, Fairgrounds seems to maybe have a little more depth. But, good product both places. And, the big name's been missing from Oaklawn. Baffert usually ships one in and More Eyes and Ooze and Oz, sometimes in Hot Springs, the first part of the meet. But I'm sure the Rebel and Arkansas Derby will produce its usual flair.
Well, let's dive in. And what are we looking forward to? It's kind of an unusual weekend. We've hit, a few of the highlights. There's not an intense weekend anywhere. There is the preview Sunday. We talked with Mary Rampolini about Sunland and what's going on there. But where'd you find your action?
Actually, I'm finding my action today, and have to give a tip of the cap to some say the competition, and at times it is. But we're all at Twin Spires hoping people avail themselves to the carryovers that the Stronach Group has today. There's a Pick 5 carryover at Golden Gate, races 1 through 5, and that race 5 at Golden Gate is, of course, part of the Stronach 5 carryover there. So hard to pass up that kind of money in these kind of pools. So I definitely took a long look at the 9 races that encompass these carryovers. Again, race 5 at Golden Gate is a part of both. And it starts with Laurel race 9, and I'm guessing with the scratches that number 3, My Cheesa Charm, is going to be the favorite and certainly the horse to beat. But I think number 5, Big Mama, at 15-1, which we probably won't get with the scratches, but I do think this one will be enough of an outsider that maybe we can separate early. Going to be on all my tickets. There's some speed in here, even with the scratches. I think Polarization maybe goes with My Cheesa Charm, perhaps some others, and that could set it up for Big Mama. So I'm looking to blow up that Stronach 5 right off the rip, Steve.
All right. Any other elements of this?
I'm on the wrong page here. Here we go. That Golden Gate race 5, we're hoping we're live to close the pick 5, and then this is also, I think, the fourth leg of the Stronach 5 going into Santa Anita. But there's a first-time starter in race 5 at Golden Gate, and it's number 3, No Key K-No, 30-1 on the morning line. Now, the negative is that the sire has never thrown a debut winner. So that's, you don't love that. But at 30-1 on the morning line, there are enough positives that this horse just has to be on my tickets at that kind of morning line price. The Dam has had debut winners before. To me, the trainer is more than capable. The stats aren't like otherworldly, but has won at this level with debut runners before. So comfortable that the trainer, who has good stats in other categories as well, Sherman, can have this horse ready at a big price. And then the jockey, who I believe is still looking for victory number 1 career-wise, but has had horses in the right spot and really is never ridden well-meant horses and is on another outsider here. But you get 10 pounds against the field, let's face it, $8,000 maiden claimers isn't world beaters, and the 10 pounds, I think, can make a difference for a female family that's shown an ability to get a first out winner before. So no Kike, no, 30-1. It's just one of those that you put on the ticket and you're gambling a little bit, but is the type that, you know, keys a five-figure payout.
No, absolutely. They're both, and you know, Hammer touched on the whole sequence today. Starts at 4:30 at Laurel, and you're not going to get away with skinny tickets. It doesn't look like in this sequence.
No, and it ends with, or excuse me, that Golden Gate Race 5 is the biggest field of the five at Golden Gate. And there's probably some other areas within that pick five to lean on. So I think both are worth a look, because the Golden Gate's a $40,000 carryover. And then with the dollar pick five increment and the Stronach 5, just really if you can be right on where you decide to narrow and then catch a horse like that first-time starter I mentioned, It's a $10,000-$20,000 number.
No, it should be a lot of fun, and should be well worth pursuing. I just put up Gus Alonso's suggested action at it and approach. So that's up at the At the Races website, and of course Gus's Gulfstream analysis Saturdays at Brisnet.
Absolutely, yep. Full card at Gulfstream, and that's the only one he did this week. But as the Derby action picks up again with big events throughout the country over the next 2 weeks, I'm sure he'll be folding in opinions from other locales as well, as he's done with Fairgrounds and Oaklawn already this year. This one's outside the Stronach 5 and Golden Gate, obviously. But I wanted to mention the 7th at Aqueduct, Steve. Mile and an eighth, $50,000 claimers, a pretty good group, and I definitely see Lang Dharma as a worthy favorite, even with the scratch of stable-made Ironclad. I do think Lang Dharma will still take money, even though it's not an entry, but I thought that might be a spot to go against the heavy favorite. And Roaming Union, I thought, had a shot with Ironclad and Colt Mississippi both being out, and Uncle Cy. I thought Roaming Union really gets a big pace advantage bump against this group. And we'll see if we end up getting 4-1 in the suppressed field. But this is a shot where I'm definitely going to be looking at the win pool at Roaming Union. Probably I'd even be willing to take 5-2 or 3-1. I just think this one can get out in the lead and not stop.
Good job. All right.
So, yeah, we're all over the place today. And
that's all right.
Like you said, yeah, yesterday with, or excuse me, tomorrow, the Darth of Derby action, and we'll certainly be paying attention to the three-year-olds and looking forward to Scully's report next week. But, yeah, with the Friday races today and those carryovers, I got excited for the card. So those were some plays I'm looking at.
Excellent. Well, Ed, as always, I appreciate it. And next week we'll have plenty to discuss, given what's a remarkable sequence of stake action at Gulfstream, with the Fountain of Youth being the centerpiece. But looking forward to that as well, and all the help you get from the Brisnet team. We're going to stay right here because we've got 20-plus minutes to close out this morning. Coming to you from Savannah, and Barry Meadow is going to join us to talk about his new book. And for those of you that don't have his earlier book, you've had up. Oh, wait a minute, we're still tap dancing for Barry's, huh? Let me give you this one case instead. We'll try one more, and I guess the numbers that I have sent have been misdirections. Yeah, here we go. Give this the. There you go. Give that one a shot. That's my third option. Money Secrets at the Racetrack, which is 30 years old? 30 years old, I think. And yes, when you read it, there's some dated references and things about, you know, the game that has changed. I mean, most notably the portion about the regularity of starts and you know, some of the class distinctions. But the principles don't they don't change. And that's really true of you know, virtually every major, important, you know, long-lasting handicapping advice book. Andy Beyer and Chris and Davidowitz with the betting thoroughbreds. But what Barry Meadow put in players' hands in Money Secrets at the racetrack has been, you know, a go-to reference for probably now, what, two and a half generations of players. And Barry has been prolific in his writing, but in terms of books and publishing, you know, something like this, the skeptical handicapper, I mean, this was a big undertaking with tremendous amounts of research, and that's a timely topic in itself, using data and brains to win at the racetrack. The skeptical handicapper, it's always a pleasure to have Barry Meadow join us. Barry, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
Outstanding. And been looking forward to this, and we're going to have a few conversations with in the coming weeks, get you back and talk about elements of skeptical handicapper. But after, you know, an extensive period without a tome, coming forth, what got you to get, you know, sit down and do this work and come out with skeptical handicapper?
You need to write a book at least once every 30 years, so I guess my next one will be 30 years from now. I'd say the main reason I wrote it is I've always been dissatisfied with most of the writing about thoroughbreds. I mean, I played the races full-time for over 20 years, but that was my main source of income. And I like to read everything. I have a very large library of racing books. And unfortunately, most of them came before the availability of computers. And computers have changed things completely. Now we have data to look at different factors. And so what I did, I worked with Ken Massa of Handicapping Technology and Research, who's done research for many, many years. And we decided, let's check a lot of the theories. Let's see what actually happens if you bet 50,000 class drivers. What do you bet first-time Lasix horses that finished in the top three in their last race? What happens if you check these things on thousands and thousands and thousands of races? So we looked at every race between 2014 and 2017 nationwide, 168,000 races. And adding those results to my background of having gambled on these things, I think I've come up with something special. Why didn't I write a book before? I was too busy gambling most of the time. I retired in 2011. I didn't have time to work on new books because I was looking at races every single day, watching replays at midnight while everybody else was sleeping.
When it came to distilling the information that the charts, that these results gleaned, what stood out to you immediately?
How good the public is. The public is an unbelievable handicapper. I mean, their 2-to-1 shots win more than their 5-to-2 shots. And the obvious factors that most players look at, for example, players are saying, where can I get a better speed figure? Well, I found out it doesn't really matter. Because you play the horse with the best speed figures, you win a lot of races, but you don't make any money because the public gloms on to this. You look at horses with good form, they win, but again, you can't make money at it. And so you follow the top jockeys, so forth. So if you're looking at obvious factors, the public has already figured this out. And therefore, it's better to spend your time looking at stuff that's not quite as obvious.
There's so many things that and that's why I want to get you back a few times to really flesh this out, because, you know, your experience and your understanding, you know, in line with Chris and Beyer and Maury Wolf and the Matisses. I mean, the people that are just completely, whose whole lives are intertwined with the game and with wagering and understanding the mechanics of what's going on. I'm curious what you also found in this that requires players to change their approach, that we, I don't know if you want to call them common mistakes or you know, habits and practices that need to be reevaluated. I mean, how would you describe or approach that suggestion?
Well, I'd say first the player has to look at what's his purpose in playing the horses. Now, if his purpose is to hang around with his friends, have a lot of action, have some lunch, enjoy himself. That's a totally different thing from somebody who wants to do this full-time and is very serious about it, because that involves discipline. It involves making choices, what you're going to do, how you're going to spend your money, how you're going to budget. And so when you talk about the average player versus the professional player, the average player, for example, likes to bet a lot of racetracks, likes to bet a lot of races. And to believe that there's value in every race and in every pool, it probably is not going to happen. It's like you don't go to a store and buy everything on the shelf. You have to be very selective. That doesn't mean you play one race out of 100. What it means is you have to make a decision. Is there some value for you this race? Do you believe you've looked at this race differently from the public and have come to different conclusions? And if you have, that's the time to bet. And if your opinion is exactly the same as the public, you're going to lose the track take.
And that, you know, that has been a common theme in your writing, which is a way to comprehend the difference that, you know, that is your opinion versus the public's, and then leveraging it. And, you know, you and I, in recent weeks, I told you what we've been doing with Nick Tamaro and, you know, the time to spend against bankroll management and ticket construction. And it's the reason that Money Secrets at the Racetrack is still as important and as vital as it ever was, because it's an area, Barry, that really has never been a big part of the handicapping library and you know, the written approach. It hasn't gotten the attention that it deserves, and it's one of the reasons that, you know, your work stands out and is important and helps players improve their approach to the sport.
Well, there's handicapping and there's betting. They're two different things. Now, if you look at what people sell on the internet or what people, it's always, who do you like? Which horse do you like? Who do you think is going to win this race? That doesn't really matter in the long run. It doesn't matter who wins this race. What matters is, are you getting a better price for this horse than the horse deserves? And if you make enough good bets, then you're going to win. And if you make enough bets just to be able to say, I have the winner, you're probably not going to win. This is a difficult game. There's a high takeout. And most players don't want to do the work. I mean, heck, I didn't want to do the work. I would get up early in the morning, and I'd be working late at night. But I know that's what it took to do this on a full-time basis. It's not a five-minute job. You have to, for example, you have to get some kind of routine. Most players don't want to do that. I mean, you have to decide how often you're going to play. How much time are you going to spend handicapping and doing records? What information sources are you going to use? How much time and money are you going to spend on buying things that help you with your handicapping? When are you going to handicap? The night before, early in the morning, between races? Where are you going to sit? Where are you going to bet? All kinds of decisions like that. And once you've got that down, then you have to decide how are you going to spend your handicapping and your betting time. For me, it was, I could quickly look at a race usually and say, well, my opinion looks like the crowd's opinion. I'm not going to waste more time on this race. Another race, I'd say, gee, my numbers don't seem to match what the crowd's going to bet here. Maybe we can do something.
There's also the proliferation of multi-race wagers, and, you know, you talk about the takeout, and of course, you know, even when takeout is too high, at least on the multis, you are negating it to some degree in the big multi-race wagers. There's also the twist in the last three plus decades that, you know, the deep exotics, whether it's tries and supers and now even super high five, that picking a winner is not as important as it used to be, at least if you've got a complete understanding of how to tie prospective winners together in doing this work and in building the chapters in the Skeptical Handicapper. What portion of the game as it is today and that part of it, exotics and multis, how has that come into play and changed your thinking or your suggested way of thinking?
Well, it's the same basic idea. You have to look for discrepancies between your opinion and the crowd's. Now, picking winners is important to some extent. If you're going to play a pick five, you might have to use a 4-5 shot, and if you get some prize sources in the other races, you're still in pretty good shape. So I don't want to minimize picking winners, but that's got to be tied with getting the right prices. And the right price might be 6-5 on a horse that should be 3-5, and it might be getting 12-1 on a horse that should be 5-1. So it's not just playing long shots, but it's having a discrepancy between your opinion and the crowd's. Now, as far as how this works in multi-race betting, it depends on which multi-race we're talking about. If we can key a horse in the pick three and play around him, that's fine. In the pick six, you still got five of the races to deal with. But there's been a change in recent years. Almost 40% of the money has been on these races where you cannot see what the prices are going to be. And that makes it a little bit difficult. I'll give you an example. There was a race just a few days ago at Gulfstream where a horse was 8-1 in the morning line, went off even money, and completed a pick six. Sometimes it's difficult to see what a horse is going to go off at, and that makes it difficult to make out tickets. But if you can have a reasonable idea what the horses are going to go, you know you don't want to play a ticket that just has the top two favorites in this race and the top two in the next and the top two in the next. You've got to find something that's going to separate yourself from the crowd when you do these. And you have to evaluate if it's even worth playing in the first place. I mean, for example, if it's a jackpot bet, why play it? The day count is so huge. On the other hand, if there's a carryover, and especially if there's a mandatory payout, that's a whole different ballgame.
No doubt, and this has been something we've grappled with literally since the inception of, you know, of the bet, and of course, actually, it was, you know, the inception goes much further back. You know, Puerto Rico was using it, and I think Beulah as well, and the way in which Stronach Group and notably Gulfstream, you know, made it prominent on a widespread basis, and it's, you know, it's spread to things like the Black Gold pick five at fairgrounds, and you know there's been these different versions of it. Do you believe, Barry, that it's worth ever under any circumstance going after the daily prize, because there seems to be plenty of serious players that are doing it, and if they're doing it, it makes you wonder if the thing, you know, if there isn't a reasonable approach to it.
Well, I don't tell people what to do with their own money, but if you're talking about a jackpot bet, not only don't you know what it's going to pay, you don't know if somebody else is going to hit it. So you're taking a big chance on something which is very difficult to hit. What's happened in recent years is people love bragging rights. No one wants to say, look, I just had that 480 winner. Look at me. No, they want to say, I hit the pick four for 5,000. I hit the pick six for 50,000. So people are spending more and more money buying these lottery-type tickets where your chances of hitting are small. The requirements for having a lot of money are large. And you have no idea what it's going to pay. I mean, we've all had the experience, certainly I have many times, of betting more into a pick six than the thing actually paid after I hit it. You know, I play a $1,500 ticket, the thing would come back and pay $900. Thanks a lot. So since we don't know what these things are going to pay, and one reason we don't is, let's say we're five deep in a race, we have the 6-5 favorite, and we have a 15-1 shot, and the 4-5 favorite wins by a nose. There goes our, you know, all the money we would have made. Why do people play these bets? I think because people like the big score. People like big things. They like the 100-yard kickoff return. They like the guy hitting the 3-point shot at the end of the game. They don't talk about the guy who set the screen or maybe who got the key rebound. People want these big, big things because they think that's going to make the difference. And if you do this for a long time, over many years, even hitting a couple of those big bets, which I certainly have, isn't going to make a difference when you look at the overall amount of time and money you're going to put into this game.
Let's focus on the book for a couple of minutes more as well, and as part of the not just the general discussion, but the title. What was the motivation for the skeptical portion of the skeptical handicap?
I'm a guy who, if somebody says it's a nice day, I say prove it. I'm one of those annoying people. The phrase "a real jerk" has been attached to my name more than once. So when people say something, I like to prove it. If I have something wrong with my elbow, I don't ask my friend what do you think I should do? I go to a medical professional who's seen thousands of the similar cases. And it's the same thing with handicapping. Just because people say you should be in a class trap and a jockey switch, well, let's find out if that's the case. Where people say, well, let's bet all the horses that were claimed last race by a good trainer, or let's bet all horses that are first-time geldings. I don't know. We don't know. Our first-time starters intimidated by the rail? Not what we found. No difference. We checked all the first-time starters in the country, inside post versus farthest outside post. No difference in ROI or win percentage. So I've always been one to say, let me check stuff myself. When I was first doing harness races years ago, and you couldn't get any training statistics, I just made my own. I just sat there saying, oh, the horse, the guy did this, the guy did that. I like to find out what the data says, not just what my friends say or somebody who might have an opinion. Everybody's got opinions, but I like to base it on facts. So I would rather spend the time researching, finding out what is so, rather than what somebody says. And that's where the phrase skeptical comes from.
What have you noticed in this era, Barry, as part of this research, that it may be, you know, maybe obscured to the naked eye, and particularly I'm asking that with an interest in the areas that we've come to know that between workout reports and premium performance figures, whether it's Jerry Brown and Thorograph or Ragazin, you know, whatever product, then you've got the software. Is there an area that you noticed is being underutilized, let's say, as an avenue?
No, absolutely. The less thing is obvious to the public who buys their phone or BristNet or TrackMaster, whatever they buy, the less obvious the information is, the better it is. For example, most players don't spend a lot of time looking at workouts, and yet we find workouts are extremely important for certain types of horses. And I always bought workout reports from somebody that saw the horses work out. So that's a factor. Watching replays is an edge because the teams that do this, I was just talking to a guy that runs one of these large rebate teams, and he says, yeah, the lone guy working himself at his own track can do better than we can. We have to move a lot of money through there. He can pick and choose his spots. It's a whole different kind of thing. So looking at replays, knowing how to look at replays is very important, not just looking for trouble, which is pretty much a waste of time, but really analyzing the replays, you know, with a strong eye. Breeding is another factor where people don't really know what to do with it because the information is not so easy. Body language. You have to understand why horses win and lose races. That's the most important thing. And if you understand that, then you know what you're watching. Then you know what to look for. But even so, you know, when we research, you discover stuff. For example, we compared blinkers off with blinkers on horses for all different types of horses, all types of ages. And it turns out the horses that had blinkers off did basically 10% better than horses with blinkers on. Interesting fact.
And that leads me to what I have maintained for a long time, that continues to be one of the few, you know, to me, one of the few edges or, you know, most reliable go-to factor, which is trainer intent. And you're going beyond the surface statistic and maybe putting, you know, two or three statistics, overlaying them, and, you know, understanding when certain trainers are going to be ready to win, because there are still outfits that train, you know, old school, and whether it's third off the layoff or, you know, adding in, as you say, you know, putting blinkers on to maybe focus a horse. You know, the jockey comes back after a horse has made a first or second start and says, this horse needs blinkers. He's looking around. He's intimidated. You get them past that. Then you take the blinkers off or cut them back. And, you know, there's so many things that, you know, we watch a guy like Stan Huff come back to the game, Barry, and he picks up right where he left off in terms of being ready with, you know, with first time starters. I mean, there's to me the watching the trainers is still just invaluable because they're creatures of habit.
Well, Steve, you know, you put your finger on something we found through the research as well. Trainers are much more important than jockeys. And if you know a particular trainer, how he prepares his horses, why he entered the horse in a claimer instead of in a lounge, how he does off his layoffs, and you really focus in on individual trainers, that's a big advantage for people that are just looking at an overall percentage. Because some players, you can't simply bet the top trainers blindly and expect to win. That's not going to happen. But you can use their skill to help you figure out what a horse is doing in a race. And that's a very important part of handicapping. Why is he in this race and not in the other race?
We've got to go through chapters, and there's some things in here that are just amazing. As I explained to people early when I said you were going to be on, Barry, that anybody that has read Money Secrets at the Racetrack know that reading, you know, your writing, you got to go back and you got to read each chapter a couple of times, because there's things you miss, and there's layers and layers, and this one is going to be an ongoing resource and a tremendous service to players. So we'll have you back soon. In the meantime, and we'll keep, you know, fleshing this out, and you're going to help us as well with Game Builder and you know the project that we're going to dedicate the year to, which is helping players do a better job with bankroll management and with ticket building. But tell them how they can pre-order, because you're just days away from getting ready to ship.
Well, they can send me an email, Barry, B-A-R-R-Y, at TR Publishing, which stands for Thoroughbred Racing, trpublishing.com. Or they can just go to my website, trpublishing.com. That has all the information over there.
Well, and Barry will sign the copies of the Skeptical Handicapper for you, and it is absolutely going to be an automatic addition to anybody that's serious about the game is going to add it. And if you're going to order it online, you should also be ordering a copy of Money Secrets at the Racetrack while you're at it, the most important pamphlet since Common Sense.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate your kind words, Steve.
Barry, we'll look forward to talking to you soon. The book starts shipping March 1st, The Skeptical Handicapper, Using Data and Brains to Win at the Racetrack. Barry Meadow, always a pleasure.
Thanks a lot. Nice being here.
Barry Meadow, everybody. And Barry, I mean, anybody that has been around the game knows what he brings to the party. And this was a party, a three-hour party that wraps up with Barry's visit, and we'll have him back in coming weeks. Jack Gilligan started us off, and that was fun. And there's his, I got to give you the link to his dad's book too, that the book that his father wrote about traveling with Jack as he made his way with the bug. Jay Pribman, Mary Rampolini, Nick Tamaro, Hammer, and Ed DeRosa. We missed Tom today. We missed Tom Quigley. We'll get him next week. I promise. All right? Good luck if you're playing today. And that includes, of course, the Stronach 5, the carryover sequence, and everything this weekend. Back with you from New York. Right, honey, Tina? We are going to go back to New York? We are?
Eventually.
All right, we're going to Charleston now, but we'll talk to you Monday from home. Thanks to Casey as well. Good luck this weekend, everybody. Talk to you soon.
latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.